Hey, it's Tom here, and welcome back to another episode of the Investing with Tom podcast and the very first episode of 2023. Now, in this episode, we have a pretty popular returning guest in Tobias Carlisle of Acquirers Funds. Some of you may have seen Toby's work through some of the value investing books that he's written, including The Acquirers Multiple, and some of you may be familiar with Toby through him being one of the three hosts of the Value After Hours podcast, which I certainly am an avid listener of. Now, in this episode with Toby, we talk through some of his work around running two deep value ETFs and his current strategy for finding deep value stocks in the market. We also talk through the current opportunity set for value investors and for a deep value type strategy with current market conditions. And I also put quite a few audience questions that were collected over on Twitter to Toby in this episode as well. So this was a really fun one to record, and I think it's a nice way to start off 2023. And speaking of kicking off a new year, I thought it would be really nice for us to do an updated sort of intro clip and even update the soundtrack here on the podcast. So let's roll straight into this episode. I hope you enjoy our new podcast theme song, and I hope you enjoy this episode with Toby Carlisle. Toby Carlisle, the man, the myth, the legend, is back on the podcast. First guest of 2023. Thanks so much for making the time, Toby. It's been, I think, close to 2 years since you're on the podcast the first time. So appreciate you making the effort. How's things with you?
Yeah, I can't believe it's 2 years. I guess I saw you at Berkshire in Omaha last year. And it turns out you're a brute, mate. You're a giant man. I had no idea.
we got a few of those comments. Yeah, I think me, Hamish, and Brandon apparently are all much taller than expected.
Then you look.
As if
anybody can tell. Yeah, it's good to be back. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be the first man back this year.
Yeah, this should be a good one. It's been a whole lot's happened, I think, since we last caught up. I guess maybe just to kick this off, like how has the past couple of years been for you? I know you're running two ETFs at this point, been fairly volatile markets, potentially the return of value in more recent times. I guess how's things been for you?
Yeah, so the way I measure the relative performance of value sort of generally in my funds more specifically is against, you know, the benchmarks and the indexes, and the absolute bottom of like a decade of underperformance by my calculation was about September 2020, and it had been pretty miserable up until that point. You know, there were many suggestions that the value had just stopped working, and we were all trying to diagnose what was wrong with value. I don't know if you remember this, but for years, you know, because it really ran into a brick wall around. It had been underperforming, like depending on how you measure it, from about 2010, but then it really ran into a brick wall in like 2015, and it lagged badly through to sort of 2018, and then it just fell off a cliff. And like those three periods were increasingly kind of dire for value guys. And I was wondering what was wrong. It's, you know, there were lots of suggestions. Is it because there are so many people who are now practicing this sort of style of investment that it's just too crowded? And that's entirely possible. My co-anchor on the little podcast that I have, Jake Taylor, on Value After Hours, he wrote this paper in about 2015 where he said the value spread was very tight, which means that the most overvalued and the most undervalued were basically trading on pretty comparable multiples. You weren't getting paid any premium for the better quality that you typically find in the more overvalued stocks. And it turns out that's a pretty good sign that the more expensive, higher quality stuff is going to go on a good run. And value lagged really badly through there. And so I've been saying for a while that the value spread has reached these sort of historical widths, or it's wider than it's ever been before. And it continues to be extremely wide. It's not narrowed much, but it has started narrowing. And this is only a much more recent phenomenon in the last sort of few months, depending on how you measure it. So my preferred, the way I like to measure it, is enterprise value, which is market cap plus debt plus anything that's like debt So that's what you pay. And then EBIT, operating income, which is a flow that you get. And so the expensive stuff, you pay a very big EV for not much operating income. And the cheap stuff, you don't pay much EV for a whole lot of operating income. And that spread between those two was as wide as it's ever got. And I think it got, the widest it has ever got was either October last year or November last year. And it sort of closed a little bit since then, but not much. And so there's still a very long way to go in that particular part. But since September 2020, when value was really, really beaten up, it has outperformed. So it's done better on a relative basis. The sad thing is that we've sort of run into this, which I've been sort of thinking was on the cards anyway, because it's a pretty classical path that the market tends to follow when it goes through one of these more, you know, bullish, boomy, bubbly types of periods, that there is often a pretty big crash on the other side, which I still think the brunt of is yet to happen. But we've seen a long period of it now. And, you know, long only value has done much better on a relative basis to the other, certainly to the very expensive stocks. You know, so if you think of like Cathie Wood's ARK as representative of the most overvalued stuff.
The anti-Toby, I think it's otherwise known as.
You know, it's crazy because I used to run, I'm not long short anymore, but I was long short for a while there. And my short book was basically ARK. You know, it was like ARK's holdings. And I used to laugh. And then that short ARK ETF came out. Yeah. And then he timed it really well. I decided to take the shorts off just because I couldn't live with having the shorts on. But so my sort of style of value, deeper value, has outperformed pretty materially since then. But it's been in a market where everything's been falling, so there's really nothing to write home about. Where we are down from our peak, but not nearly as much as they are. Like, to the extent that that's anything, it's the only shred of anything that I'm holding on to right now.
Yeah, nice. Can you just speak to the couple of ETFs you do have at the moment? And you mentioned briefly there that you're no longer have the shorts, at least in ZIG, I think you can.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe run us through what's going on there. But can you talk us through kind of the strategy for both those ETFs and some of the changes that have happened in the last year or so, and why that was the case?
So there are two. I run two ETFs. One is ZIG, which is the acquirer's fund, and that's a mid-cap, large-cap US listed stocks. And the other is DEEP, which is small and micro. And they're all also US listed stocks. It's exactly the same sort of method of picking the stocks in both. And often the same stocks will appear where there's some overlap. If I buy something in DEEP and it gets a little bit bigger, I can also buy it in ZIG and vice versa. If I buy something in ZIG and it goes down, it may end up in DEEP as well if it's sort of on that cutoff. That wasn't sort of planned at the outset. I set up ZIG first and I created that ETF. And it was long short originally. And it was supposed to be sort of, that was mid cap, large cap is the most liquid. I think it's mid cap is sort of this underappreciated part of the market, which gets typically, it has that sort of outperformance characteristics of small and micro. So small and micro, you know, if people think about the way that you outperform an index, which is typically market capitalization weighted, sometimes it's float adjusted, but that means that basically the bigger companies get the most weight in the index and the smallest companies get a lower weight. What researchers have found is that the way to outperform that index is you do various things. You buy the smaller stocks, they tend to outperform. Value stocks tend to outperform. And there are lots of other things, but those are the two things that I was trying to get into the portfolio. Mid-cap delivers that performance, the sort of return characteristics of small and micro, but at the same time, it has the volatility characteristics of large cap. And so if you academic finance guys like that combination because it delivers higher returns with lower volatility, to the extent that, you know, for me, that's not what I'm seeking to create. That's a byproduct of what I do. But I just think if that advantage is there, then I was going to take it and exploit it. And so that's what the fund is set up to do, in addition to sort of being a value fund. And then in, I think it was March or June 2020, one of the competitors to ZIG, which was a very big fund, had about $350 million in it, but it was a part of a $12 billion complex of other funds. They just didn't want to run it anymore. I think the performance had been so bad for so long. They were just tired of Vay.
It's a good sign to get in there, Toby.
Yeah, yeah, really. And so they sort of handed it back to my service providers and my service providers. And I partnered with another group, Roundhill. We took it over and switched it to a small and micro fund. And so that's what it is now. So I have all value split into two funds. And one is small and micro and one is mid and large. So Zig started out long short. I was terrified of the overvaluation in the market when I launched. I've been thinking that something pretty nasty has been coming for a long time. Like, I've been talking about it at least since 2015, something like that. So that's not a great track record. I'm not saying that. So that makes me look like an idiot, but that's genuinely what I think. The market gets too expensive. All that means is forward returns get lower and you get much more volatility. And it takes a long, long time, evidently, for that to sort of manifest, and it has manifest now. So we've seen 12 months of sort of down for the index. Big crashes tend to be about 12 months, about 18 months to 2 years before you see the bottom. So on that basis, if this is one of those crashes, it's sort of another 18 months. It's another 6 months to 12 months before we see the sort of final crescendo of selling in it. The nice thing about value and the bad thing about value is that it tends to sort of follow a little bit of an idiosyncratic path. It doesn't necessarily track along with the market. So had that very long period of underperformance from 2015 to 2020. And the same thing happened in the late 1990s. It had value, had this really terrible underperformance while the frothier stocks sort of ran away. But then in the early 2000s, value had this big catch-up period and the rest of the market sort of traded sideways. So the very big companies, like often people think of the late 1990s as being a tech boom and crash, but really it was a big company boom and crash. And there were many big companies in there that weren't necessarily tech. So Walmart, not really a tech company, but still a phenomenal company. But from 2000 to 2015, it just went sideways because it was so expensive in 2000. That also happened to Microsoft and GE, and GE has other problems, but all of those sort of companies had that issue where they got too expensive and traded sideways. And then there was this period of time where value did really well. And that idiosyncratic return path where it doesn't really follow what the index does means that it's possible that you can have value could have a very good run here while the market doesn't do very well. So it's not super helpful to look at the market, but it's worthwhile bearing in mind that you probably are, you know, you're bound by the same basic laws of nature. You know, if the market goes down, it's highly likely that value sells off too. So I was long short originally going into that because I wanted some ability to protect to the downside. I think the idea would have been that if you're short the stuff that is in the ARK type companies, when the market goes down, they just tend to go down a lot more than the market, which is what has happened. And value stocks just tend to be a little bit more resilient, provided you haven't overpaid for them. And so the longs would have held up a little bit better and the shorts would have paid off more. I decided to take them off ultimately, not because the shorts sort of went crazy. I don't know if you remember, but there were like companies when they filed for bankruptcy were going up. And we're still seeing that today with like Bed Bath and Beyond is close. And it's trading up, like it's having 50% up days and stuff like that. But there were people like the moment that Hertz went into bankruptcy, the stock went crazy. And there were things like AMC, like they're just not very good businesses, not very good companies, but trading like crazy because they became a little bit meme stockish. I wouldn't ever be short that kind of stuff because one of the things I look for is to make sure that there's not a great deal of short interest. I think that's a good way to short. Short interest just shows how many other people are short a stock. Crowded shorts, they do tend to go down. You don't want to own them from the long side, but the cost of borrow becomes very, very expensive. So they're hard to short too. Kind of paradoxically, it's hard to make money long and short in these kind of companies. And I know that makes no sense, but it is the case. But the thing that I didn't like ultimately was that there's leverage in it. If you're short something, you know, people always say, well, a short can go to infinity and you can be, you know, blown out when it runs to infinity. In reality, there are lots of ways to protect against that. You make sure they're really small and you rebalance and do all those sort of things. But it is this sort of existential risk that you could be in the wrong thing, that you wake up one day and it's up 10 times or something and it just blows a hole in the portfolio. And I thought that really the smartest thing to do is just to take out, like, I'm just going to go through and pluck out any bit of risk from the funds that I can find. And the lowest hanging fruit was the shorts. So even though it introduces this mark-to-market risk on the longs, like they could trade down quite a lot at any given time, the market could be down 50%. Or up 50% over the course of the year. That's sort of my, at the start of the year, if you ask me, like, what's the base case? I would say you have to be able to survive a 50% drawdown and you have to be able to participate in a 50% upside. And if you can do both of those things, then you've got a pretty well-constructed portfolio. And if you can't, then you're kind of betting on one thing or the other thing happening. And, you know, your guess is as good as mine about which one of those things is going to happen. So I just went through and I thought, I'll take out the risk so I'm not worried about what the market does. And then I'll try to become sort of less predictive. I'll just say it doesn't matter what happens. I'm going to try to do a little bit better in any market. So that's sort of the philosophy that I have these days.
Yeah, nice. And on the long side, what does that process look like now? I remember reading The Acquirer's Multiple a couple of years ago, and which is a great and relatively quick read because I tend to lose concentration reading really long books. So that was a nice one for me. So definitely recommend checking that out if people are keen. But it seems like just looking through the portfolio, there's kind of a range of stocks. If you look at them on like an Acquirer's Multiple basis, there's things like, I saw Steel Dynamics in there at like 3x EV EBIT, and then O'Reilly Automotive at like 20 times, for example. So yeah, I guess what's your thought process there? How do you approach the long side? Because it looks like it's potentially not purely just valuation.
Yeah, so no, it's purely valuation, but it's not purely deep value. So one of the little changes that I had was that, you know, I wrote pretty extensively in Acquirer's Multiple about how it is the very cheapest stocks that tend to outperform over the long run. So the Acquirer's Multiple compares the magic formula, which is Joel Greenblatt's idea, where he has two factors where he says, let's look at return on invested capital as an indication of how high quality a business is. And he looks at enterprise value to EBIT, which is my Acquirer's Multiple, to see how cheap a company is. And he says, if they're good and cheap, that's a good buy. And if they're expensive and not very good, then that's something to avoid. And then there's every sort of mix in between. When I compared the two, I found that just buying cheap tends to do better, and on a risk adjusted basis, which makes no sense. Well, like, that's the volatility adjusted basis, to the extent that anybody cares about that. But you can care about that you'll notice the real pain that people feel is tracking error, which is when value's massively underperforming, the rest of the market's doing fine. It's just hard to hold value, and it does that a lot. It just tends to, it's either at a new all-time high or it's drawing down, and that's just the way that it is. And so that the drawdowns can be, you know, they can be very, very long, years and decades potentially, which I didn't sort of really, I knew that in a theoretical sense, but having endured it in an actual sense, it's very painful. It's hard to do, and you'll be kind of questioning your sanity the whole way through. I was very lucky that I had Jake Taylor there the whole time. We would talk to each other and say, you know, I'd say, as far as I can tell, this process is still rational, and therefore I think the only breakdown is that we've lost our mind. But I think, you know, you're sane and I think I'm sane, so I think it's okay. A good approach, I think. It's still a good approach. Having said that, I could see that there were still things there are things out there that don't qualify as deep value, but are clearly undervalued. And so I think that I just wanted to get a variety of different value styles into the portfolio. And O'Reilly is a good example of what O'Reilly is they sell car parts and car accessories and things like that. And they always trade really cheaply because I think that there's this, again, I hate to keep on using this word existential, but it's a good word in this instance, existential threat of cars becoming electric, this transition to EVs, and people won't be going into O'Reilly as much. As a result, it throws off enormous amounts of cash, and management's been very good for a very long time at using that cash to buy back cheap stock. And so that the thesis there is just a cash flow engine that buys back stock, and you end up doing quite well in businesses like that. And so I'm always on the lookout for that style of business. I'm also on the lookout for things that are just absolutely cheap. If something's trading at two or three times, you know, sustainable earnings of what it could do over the next few years, I think it's worth taking a look at, particularly if management is doing something about the undervaluation. So in any given quarter, because I rebalance quarterly back to equal weight, in any given quarter, it's funny to look at the styles that work better in the portfolio. So if you were to look in the portfolio, you know, say a year ago, it was more of I'm not shallow value, that's not a very good name for it, but like the better quality value companies were doing a little bit better. And then we've had this like commodity bubble boom as well, where for whatever supply constraint reasons or whatever it is, commodities have run really hard. And so this quarter, if you look in the portfolio, all of the stuff that's outperformed is all of the commodity, more traditional deep value. So if you look at the portfolio now, it looks like it's weighted towards more sort of commodity deeper value stuff. And I'm just trying to get both into the portfolio. I'm trying to take anything that's undervalued in a pretty wide range, because I don't want to predict which one's going to work. I think that there are a lot of people predicting now that it is going to be a deep value run, and it is the cheapest decile or the cheapest quintile that has, and that's the cheapest fifth, the cheapest 20% or the cheapest 10% of the market that just hasn't participated. And all of the other, so that you can divide the market into five buckets on a value metric like enterprise value to EBIT, my acquirer's multiple. And the most expensive bucket, that's the glamour stocks or the growth stocks or whatever you want to call it. And then the cheapest bucket is like the deep value stocks. And this analysis that I think it's GMO who's just brought it out, they say that buckets, the most expensive bucket, bucket one, bucket two, bucket three, are very, very overvalued. But then they say bucket four, which is getting close to being deep valued, is also overvalued relative to its long run history. And the only place that you can find value is in that deepest value bucket. And so everybody seems to be guessing now that it's going to be a value, a deep value run, and trying to concentrate into deep value. I think that's probably right. I think that's probably what happens, but I don't know. And this, if anything, if I've learned anything in the markets, it's that whatever you think is going to happen is going to be confounded by something that you didn't expect or you didn't predict. And so I just try not to predict anymore. I just try to say, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just going to be in the most undervalued stuff the way that I assess it. And I hope that it works out. Let the cards fall where they may.
And is that approach to the long side changed since first launching Zig? Like, would you say it's a little more actively managed as opposed to systematic when it first launched, or is it always been some systematic sort of approach?
So I try to do a blend of both, where basically and you're not supposed to do that, but this is my rationale for doing it. So what the pure quant guys will say is that, you know, and this is like taken from all of the, there's enormous amounts of research in lots of different places. So you look at wine vintages or the chance that criminals commit crimes again, recidivism, or the college kids getting into or high school kids getting into a college. There are all of these different, you know, simple statistical analyses that you can do to work out who's going to succeed in the next sort of, you're predicting from a pool into another pool, which is basically what you're doing when you're picking stocks. And all the quants will say that when you do that analysis, once you've settled on whatever your simple rule is going to be, you should never override the model, because if you override, you didn't do that in backtest. If you override the model in reality, you're going to be interfering with the performance of the model. And everybody thinks that the performance is, the model is the floor and you add to the performance, when in reality the model is the ceiling and you detract from that performance. That's what all the quants say. And if you look at someone like Jim Simons, whose Medallion or Reef, the two funds that they manage, he will say exactly the same thing. We implement the models, and they're doing very, very sophisticated stuff. I'm not trying to compare myself to them. I'm just saying that I'm interested in their process as well. But then you'll also find Jim Simon saying in the quant quake in 2007 that he took some of his positions off. And his philosophy then was that he wanted to survive that more than he wanted to make a whole lot of money in it. And the thing that I come back to over and over again, and sort of my driving desire and my driving goal these days, is survival at all costs in every single market. So I will look at stocks that sometimes I'll look at stocks that the model has picked up, and I do this forensic diligence on them afterwards to make sure that the model is identifying sort of economic undervaluation and not just sort of statistical undervaluation that's clearly not undervalued for some other reason. But what I'm really looking for is stuff that it's just a fraud. It's just an obvious fraud, or there's an obvious problem with the stock that it's not picking up. Now, I have tracked the performance of those funds against this sort of theoretical model, and it does slightly underperform the theoretical model, just as you would expect from all of the literature. But the reason that I do it is that I think that I don't mind underperforming. I don't mind paying that little, you know, that little fee or whatever it is, that little tax to ensure survival. I think of it as like it's some sort of like little option value on survival. And I think that survival is the most important thing. So I'm trying to avoid the riskiest stuff in order to deliver a sort of a satisfactory return, rather than trying to maximize the return and introducing more risk into the portfolio. So that's kind of the way I think about it.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. Maybe just switching tack very slightly. You mentioned the value spread a little earlier before. I know you interviewed Cliff Asness, I think, a year or two ago, which was really good. And I see he just put out another update of his value spread. I think we've gone from something like the 99th or 98th percentile to the 94th. And one of the things we spoke about a year and a half ago with the value spread was one of the arguments that's out there all the time saying that the spread should be wide is, you know, interest rates are really low, and that's obviously changed a fair bit as well. Do you have any sort of comments on where those couple of things sit at the moment and how you think that might impact what you're doing?
Yeah, so what drives the spread? I don't know. I like the interest rate argument. I think that just too low interest rates push up the more overvalued stuff well beyond sort of any sensible level. And, you know, there's this argument that it's this duration. They call it duration, which is like a bond investing term. So something that is short duration. So if you think about the treasuries, US government treasuries, they're supposed to be risk-free. Like, that's the substitution for the risk-free rate. They're not risk-free, but what they are is they're supposed to be default risk-free. The US government, it has defaulted, but for the sake of this academic exercise, the way that everybody thinks about it, it's the lowest risk option in the market is the way that you're supposed to think about these things. So you're taking risk off the table when you're looking at this. All that you're looking at is the length of time that you have your money in these instruments. And so you can put it out there for a very short period of time, days, or you can put it out for a very long period of time, 30 years. And interest rates will, this is like introductory finance 101, interest rates will impact the 30-year treasury. Movements in the interest rates will affect the 30-year treasury more than they impact the short-term one. And you can build a simple model and discover this for yourself. This is just the case. So when interest rates go down, the 30-year treasury goes up a lot. When interest rates go up, the 30-year treasury goes down a lot, and certainly relative to the shorter term stuff. And so what people were saying, and I like this argument. What they were saying was that the growth stocks, they don't have any cash flows now. All of their cash flows are back-end loaded. You have to look a long way out. And so they're more like a 30-year treasury. And growth stocks, they are earning all of their cash flows now. But the concern is usually that the cash flows are declining. Like, they're not as good as these other businesses. And so the cash flows are front-end loaded. They're much more like those short-term duration. And so the interest rate moves don't affect them as much. So when interest rates went down, the growthier stocks, which are like the 30-year treasury, went up a lot. And value stocks sort of weren't impacted much or as much. I like that argument. Cliff has sort of looked at it, or his colleagues have looked at it through lots of different, they've looked at the interest rate term structure, the absolute rate of interest rates, different rates. They couldn't find any sort of connection between the movements and the rates and the performance of these stocks. So have to be skeptical of that idea, even though I kind of like it. The other thing is, I just think from a business perspective, if money is sort of abundant, if it's easy to get access to a whole lot of money, then ideas that have a lower threshold, or have a low threshold for working out, if you have a project that you expect it'll return 10% a year and interest rates are at 5%, that project is worth two times your money put into a 5% interest rate. But if you have one that's worth 5%, can deliver 5% a year, it's worth one times, and you might not do it. You might not want to take on the risk. But if rates are at 1% and you've got a 5% project, now that 5% project is all of a sudden something that might be worth looking into, and you rationally invest in that because you get a better return than you do out of low interest rates. And I think that that's a lot of what happened. No, it's not as straightforward and simple as that when you're making any individual decision, but collectively across the entire economy with everybody making these investment decisions, lower rates just mean higher asset prices, and it means marginal projects get funded that wouldn't otherwise be funded. And I kind of think that's what happened. You're looking for a return somewhere because the rates are so low. I think they were probably below the rate of inflation, even though the headline rate of inflation was whatever it was. The actual real rate of inflation that people experienced was higher than the interest rates that they could earn. And so they were encouraged up the risk curve to sort of get enough return to keep up with the market. And then they look at what's working. And really the only thing that was working was large US equities and this sort of speculative tech type stuff. And so it just drove an enormous amount of money into it, and it becomes self-reinforcing. So I don't know if you remember that it's before your time, but in dot-com 1.0, there was this very famous fund management group. It was just like ARK. They were called Janus Funds, named after the god, the two-faced god. But they had this problem where they were performing well because they were sticking a whole lot of money into the market, which would produce, just by sheer weight of the amount of money that they were sticking into the market, they would push up these small tech issues. And then that would appear as good performance, which would help them raise more money, and they'd stick more into these tech issues. And then it got to a point where they just saturated the market and it reversed. And then of course the same thing happened in reverse that had happened on the way up, and that market, their holdings were down 99% or something like that. I think the same thing has happened with ARK. They tended to invest in smaller, lower float businesses, and that pushed them up. That turned out as great performance and more money flowed in. And that buy the dip mentality had just worked for so long, where anybody who had any ounce of fear was just sort of blown out of that market. If you had hedged or invested in anything other than those biggest tech stocks, then you were underperforming. And only the people who were like the highest risk people in the market were keeping up or doing better than the market. And then, of course, that's reversed. And I don't think it's over for ARK yet either. I think ARK's about, in terms of time, they topped out in February 21. I think it was 156 at the peak. I don't know where they are now, but they're between 30 and 40, something like that now. So they're down, whatever that is, 80%, something like that from the peak. If I look at their portfolio, I still think that they could easily come down another half from here across that portfolio, which would be 90% peak to trough. So I think that's, it all feeds on itself. It's all related. It's interest rates, and it's interest rates just being set too low, interest rates being moved lower, and then people sort of seeing that happen and then forcing money into it. And it creates these Uber bubbles, and then the reversal is just as nasty. And I don't think it's over yet.
Mm. And what does that mean for the little value investor, you think, Toby?
Well, you got to survive. That's the first thing. So you don't want to be levered into it, because when there's genuine fear in the market, when there's like March 2020 fear in the market, or March 2009, Q3 2008, Q1 2009 fear, it doesn't matter what you hold. the market gets irrational. It's either forced selling because people are levered into it, or people just get tired of the market going down all the time and they just sell out. And there'll be this crescendo of selling at the bottom. So value guys have the advantage that, for one thing, you're looking at something other than the price. You're looking at underlying value, and that really doesn't change much quarter to quarter. It varies a little bit, and you can see how your mark is, your price is relative to your value. And so if it gets cheaper, potentially buy some more. But you just want to make sure that you're not levered so that you become a forced seller too. As long as you're long only, or you've got some cash to invest, it's really a great time. I had silly opportunities available in March 2009 that ultimately turned into very good returns. And I think the same thing, already is happening, that there are already, the forward returns are unusually good. I don't know what percentile we're in, but we're in the 90 or 95th percentile for forward returns for value right now, which is somewhat related to where the spread is. Whereas I think the market is in, the forward returns for the market are very low, are unusually low. So that's why I think it's likely that value outperforms, and particularly small value outperforms here. So value, just got to keep, you really have to just try to tune out what is going on for everybody else and just sort of focus on your own assessment of a company. My bias, and I think this is borne out a little bit in the research, although, opinions vary about this, but I prefer to be not particularly concentrated. I like 30 positions in my bigger fund, and I've got 100 in my smaller fund. Whereas, there are some guys who advocate for heavy concentration, or they advocate for a sort of, just blanking on it at the moment, the Kelly criterion type approach where you just size up your position when you got the edge over the odds. It's just so hard to make that calculation, and it's so hard to have a whole lot of your portfolio in a handful of stocks. And I think it alters your behavior a little bit, and that is not accounted for in this purely rational application of the Kelly criterion. It's just very hard to have all of your portfolio riding on the performance of a handful of stocks. I think you'd do much better when, I've got 3% in Facebook. And Facebook went down all last year, and it's bounced pretty well this year. If I had 20% of my book in Facebook, I probably wouldn't have been sleeping at night. But with 3%, if it halves, it halves. It's 1.5%. I still think that the value, if anything, the value is up over the last 12 months. So I feel pretty good about it. I'm happy to have it sit in the portfolio. As an investor, it makes my behavior much more patient. So the more patient you become, the better your performance becomes. The less you sort of care about the performance of any individual stock, the less it's sort of, it's another trap, particularly for people who are talking in public a lot like I am, where you get associated with a stock and then, now I can't sell out of it, because if I sell out of it, then that's admitting that I've made a mistake. So I like to get out in front of everybody and say, in any quarterly rebalance, I can sell anything out of the portfolio. I don't feel that need to sort of prove out the thesis. If the thesis is broken, if there's something else in there, just switch them out and keep on going, which is hard to do with big positions because you're psychically invested in them working. So I think that's no leverage, small positions, kind of ignore what the market is doing and focus on underlying values. And really, it should be a fun period, because you'll find opportunities that you've been waiting to buy for years and years and years. You finally get your chance to buy something really good at a price that you can't believe, and then you've almost stolen it. So I think it could be fun if you can keep your wits about you.
Yeah, I agree. I think it should be a good time. And as many people do, like to follow Michael Burry on Twitter, and he reminded me, or sort of brought my attention to something the other day. I'm not sure if this is something you've spent much time looking at, but he was talking a little bit about. You talk about not having much leverage in the portfolio personally, but about sort of companies. So, internally within the portfolio that might have leverage. And there's some interesting kind of capital allocation decisions that a lot of those managers, I think, will have now, because rates have gone up and their bonds have got quite cheap. Yeah. So I don't know. It does seem early 2000s-esque, even though I wasn't investing then. But all of a
sudden, options
are opened up.
If they have the flows, that'll be great because their bonds will trade down. They can trade out. If they don't have the flows, then it's going to be very, very painful. There are lots of ways that you can... So when I talked about risk before, I define risk in many, many different ways. So I think I lost my train of thought when I was talking about that a little bit. But what I meant to say was one of the advantages of being like having this sort of quantitative approach, the big risk for many investors is that you tend to drift a little bit with what's working in the market. And so you also don't want to be too rigid. So that there's always like a qualifier to everything I say. So I'll give you the idea first, then I'll tell you the qualifier second. The idea is that you don't want to drift. So you don't want to be, you know, the only thing that's working is these mega cap tech companies. And so even though they're more expensive than I would usually pay, I can justify it because look at this compounding, you know, capital light compounding that's going to go on forever. So therefore I should buy more of those. And you tend to be in them right at the worst time. Whereas you should be sort of, you know, look at energy. It's completely bombed out. Price of oil is negative. These guys aren't going to have negative values for oil forever. They're probably going to turn around. You should have been in the bombed out energy rather than justifying buying the compounder tech. And it's hard because for the obvious reason that's underperforming so much, you look back and it doesn't look like it's very good. So you need to find a way not to drift, but equally you need to find a way not to be too rigid. You sort of, I think you need to be, and I think the solution is to be like a Bayesian updater. So that idea is you've got all of this research behind you that you, all this idea, you know, you've got this thesis for your strategy. You know what you're doing. You've got this process or this philosophy, but new information should be added and updated to it. You should be thinking all the time, but only incrementally, not like a gigantic sea change. So you make these incremental changes. One of the things that I think that's one of the things that quant is very good at is sort of being Bayesian and incrementally updating as you go along. But I think that value, like the Grahamite style value where you're assessing, you know, look at the nature of this business. Is this business one that has a huge amount of operating leverage in it? Where are you now in the cycle for this operating leverage? So oil is a good example. Oil has energy companies have enormous operating leverage. Any commodity has enormous operating leverage. Operating leverage is once you get to a break even, above that break even, every incremental dollar is more valuable to you than they're most valuable to you at the close to the point of break even. So you go from earning nothing to earning a little bit. So guys will say, I've got this thesis on, I think gold's going to rip. So what I want to do, so you could go and buy gold miners front because gold miners have a little bit of operating leverage relative to gold. They'll do much better when gold does better. So the guys will think, how do I maximize the operating leverage in this? I'll go and find the highest cost producer. Oh yeah, that's it. I'll go and find the highest cost producer of gold. Because when gold turns up, these guys will inflect massively. And then I know that that's not sustainable, so I'll sell out. And I used to think that way too. Like, where's the maximum operating leverage in this market? I don't do that anymore because I don't like, because operating leverage, obviously, it cuts both ways. It's high risk up, high risk down. So I think that's a source of risk. It's operating leverage, financial leverage, which is just having too much debt, as you pointed out before. And those are the two main, like financial leverage you can screen out. Operating leverage is much harder to screen out. You sort of have to know what you're looking at. Deep value tends to be in a lot of stuff that has high operating leverage. And so I try to balance that out by having some stuff that has some lower operating leverage in there that can still do okay. But if the world goes into Armageddon, if it's Ragnarok, which is possible, then they're still going to be okay. They'll be there on the other side. That's basically, I'm selecting them on their ability to survive the worst possible outcome and still be there on the other side, I think. And if I do that at every level, so I look at it at a company level and I look at it at a portfolio level, and if they can both survive, then that's good. I'll be there.
Nice. I actually think I heard Buffett talk about that exact same concept in a Berkshire meeting. I don't know what year, a pretty old one from memory, where he was saying, really, you want to buy the worst oil company if you're going to be some sort of trader. I don't know that he was arguing that you should actually do that or not, but
I didn't hear it from Buffett. I've heard it from lots of different dudes.
Yeah.
I thought it was super smart the first time I heard it. And then I went to, actually what happened was I went to a conference and it was exactly that idea. This is a long time ago now. This would be like 2009 or 10 or something like that. And I heard someone say their thesis, they had this idea they were going to buy like Canadian, the highest cost Canadian gold miner, because that would inflect the most. And then I went to another table and I talked to some guy and his thesis was to buy the highest cost Canadian gold miner. And like, I heard the same idea like three times and I thought, okay, what I thought was super smart at first, now it sounds like there's a lot of people who've got the same idea. So you do need to be a little bit careful about that.
Yeah. Time to short the highest cost Canadian gold miner.
Yeah. Probably get your face ripped off there too. Like, you just can't win.
Yeah, I know. It's too hard basket stuff. I want to change topic slightly. I don't know if this is something you want to speak about on the podcast or not, so if you don't want to, feel free. But I heard rumblings in the last year or so, haven't heard you talk about it for a while, that you might have a new book in the works. Is that still something you're working on?
I'm working on it all the time, and I've kind of got 90% of the rough draft written. It's just I get to this point where I don't know if it's good or if it's cringy. And I'm just like, I think I just need to give it a little bit of time to sort of settle a bit. And then I go back and I read it. And if I cringe really hard, then I'll have to rewrite some stuff. And so I've taken a break over this Christmas break and I've just been back to it the last few weeks since I've been back. It's very hard when you're close to these things. I think the thesis is pretty clear. I think the thesis is good-ish, but the idea is that there are these sort of universal laws that govern the interactions of people, and often they are in terms of survival, conflict, and conquest. That's sort of what we've spent most of our time thinking about as a species since we've been writing stuff down. So the first thing we wrote down was a book called The Epic of Gilgamesh. That was like 2800 BC, which is like 5,000 years ago. And they were talking in that book, that's about a young tyrant king who's doing all this bad stuff and then how he changes and becomes better at what he's doing. But he learns these lessons about conflict and conquest. And then like 2,500 years after he wrote that, Sun Tzu writes The Art of War in Ancient China. But they were basically, everybody lived in little walled cities. It was Bronze Age warfare. So all of the weapons were made out of tools, but they had mirrors and swords, and they were very much like we are today. And so people were Sun Tzu's trying to explain how to survive given the risks of being attacked and all of these other things. And it just, Sun Tzu's approach is basically that you have to be able to defend yourself first. So survival is a matter of defense. And then you don't want to ever engage unless you have this sort of overwhelming advantage. Otherwise, you're just flipping a coin, basically. And to me, that sounds a lot like Buffett. Buffett would say, you have to make sure that you survive and you only want to take on these like absolute no-brainer investments. And so it's really like this psychological, there's nobody playing back against you in the markets or in industry. Well, in an industry, there's competition, so it is applicable there. But in investing particularly, there's nobody on the other side. You know, it's just you and your thoughts. And the better you can get to that sort of Buffett level of focus where you just don't swing at things that you're not certain about. And part of that is just the more you do stuff, the more the setups that you recognize as being good ones. You know, there's stuff that 10 years ago, I wouldn't do things now that I did do 10 years ago. I just would do things that were higher risk if I thought there was enough return in there. And now I would rather a smaller return and no risk than a giant return and lots of risk in there, even though if you looked at them on a risk adjusted basis, that might be the better option. So that's in a sense, I think that's one of the ways that Kelly fails a little bit. You know, so that's basically what Kelly is saying. The riskier something is, the less money you put into it. The lower the risk is, the more money that you put into it. But it can still lead you into things that are very high risk. And I think that rationally, you should take that bet. But then there's another sort of stage that you should be doing where you say, well, this is this ongoing debate for Kelly type investors where they say, you know, does a guy who's already rich, does he want to put, if Kelly says you should put 80% of your portfolio into this thing because it's such a great risk reward. Is he rational putting 80% of his portfolio into something like that? Kelly would say, yes, you should, because like the edge over odds, it favors this. That's how much you should size up. But there are lots of other people who say, well, that's silly. You know, you're not going to put 80% of your portfolio and risk, you know, your quality of life. So there's some other factor there. Like, what is that other factor? That other factor is survival. Like, survival is sort of first and foremost. So that's kind of the idea. I'm trying to just work through. That's kind of the difficulty, is I have to kind of work through that idea and explain that idea and then justify why I'm doing something that's not really statistically valid. You know, rationally you should do this other thing, but it's also rational to not do it. And I'm trying to square those two away and tell stories about it as it goes on. So that's the idea of the book. It's a tough one to write. It's much, much harder than any of the other ones I've written. So it's taking a lot longer to come out, and I hope it's worthwhile. I've talked about it a lot. I have to bring it out now, unfortunately. But I wish I'd shut up about it before I'd finished it.
Yeah, it's sort of the same idea as those really, really big stock positions. If you talk about them in public, you kind of get into them sometimes.
Yeah. Behavior's a big, like the behavior of your own behavior and the behavior of other people in the market is a really sort of, I hadn't appreciated how important it was, and particularly being in, you know, being public, being on Twitter, having a podcast, talking to people, it's a little bit self-reflexive. Like, you can sort of talk yourself in and out of position. So I try to get it up front that I'm going to change my mind and nothing that I say is fixed, and I could change my mind on all of this stuff subsequently, so no one can accuse me of not being, you know, consistent.
Yeah, I think even just being aware mentally of that bias is quite a significant step, because I run into the same thing putting out YouTube videos. You know, I run a relatively concentrated portfolio, you know, personally, and yeah, you've got to be quite, you've got to go into it with the mindset of, you know, if there's facts that, you know, don't align with your thesis, you have to be able to change your mind. And initially when I started the YouTube channel, I was very hesitant to even talk about investments or companies that I was interested in. I've sort of changed my philosophy over time. I think there's been more positives than negatives. I've heard Bill talk about that on your podcast as well, to where he might have an idea about how a particular company is going to play out or what have you. And you put that out into the world, and then all of a sudden these really smart people send a bunch of info back to you, which is actually very useful. So that's kind of where I've landed on the whole thing, at least.
It's a great thing to do. Really, you just have to separate yourself from the stock position. And it's hard, particularly if, you know, you've put a lot of work into it and you want to appear smart. And so backing down, sort of admitting that, yeah, I made a mistake in public, and that's hard to do. But I think that the key is just to say, this is something that I'm thinking about. This is something that I'm interested in doing. Like, tell me what's wrong with this idea. Like, break this idea for me. And there are lots of super smart people out there on Twitter who are right in the industry, and they're able to say, this is what's wrong with it. Having said that, sometimes the people who are in an industry, the nice thing about being a generalist is that, for one thing, you can look at relative values across industries and compare those. The other thing is that it's like the things that drive the returns to stocks are, a lot of it is fundamental, and over the longer term it is fundamental, but there's also this enormous you know, crowd overestimation, underestimation, overreaction, underreaction, and that is part of what I do as a deep value guy. I'm finding stuff that people have oversold because they've got too scared of it. And if you ask people in the industry, often they're like, you know, it's a disaster. This is never going to work out. Whereas I can say, well, it's a small position. It has all the qualities of things that have outperformed in the past. And the fact that everybody doesn't like it is sort of one of the reasons that I'm here. Like, that's why it's cheap. And so you can put it on. But it's very, very hard. I've never really found the right balance between the two. I've never sort of squared the circle there. But I go back and forth. Ignore everybody, or take it all on board, or ignore everybody. If I figure it out, I'll let you know. You do the same.
Yeah, that'd be great if you could send that info by the way. Do you want to take some questions here from Twitter?
Sure.
We've got quite a few of them. Let's see. We have I asked Jack this one, so I'd better put this question to you. What's the secret? What's the secret to great hair?
Yeah, I don't know. It's going backwards at the edges here, and so it used to be. I've got this. I've got like all the sun damage from when I was a kid. I've got this part of the skin that's coming out that's unsun damaged, so it's not sticky. It's not going to last forever. I don't know. I don't want to claim it too much. I don't know. I have no idea. It's pure luck.
Pure luck. Genetics. Australian genetics.
Both of my grandfathers were bald, my dad's sort of bald. There's no justice in it at all. There's no luck.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there's no skill. There's nothing I'm doing.
Okay. All good. Yeah, that was Matt Hansen on Twitter asked that question. So you're on your own there. Sorry, Matt. Here's one from Luigi. Top three books that you'd recommend to people? That's a very broad question. Maybe anything you've read recently.
Yeah, so I loved, so the book that got me started in value investing was The Making of an American Capitalist.
Yeah, nice.
Which is the book about Buffett. And I read through that and I really liked eyes. If you, you know, all of the things that we love about Buffett, that if you sit down and you think and you look where other people aren't and you think for yourself and all those sort of things. And I thought that sounded really appealing. And I liked that approach and it just made complete sense. And so that then gave me the motivation to go and learn value investing and do all those other things. So I like that book and I recommend that book. It's hard because I can't see my bookshelf behind me. I put all of my favorite books in. Just one second. I'll just have a quick look.
Yeah, go for it.
I'm too blind to see back that far. I need to think a little bit because I read a lot. I read constantly and I read like 10% of almost every book and then don't finish the rest of it. Yeah, I need to think in terms of like investing. Well, I loved the Icahn book, King Icahn. I quoted a little bit of that in Deep Value because I liked his approach so much. But I've kind of gone away from that a little bit over the activism seemed like when I was younger, I really liked the idea of activism. As I've got older, it just seems like an enormous amount of work and bad psychic energy to be pumping out into the world to be doing that stuff. But it's kind of interesting. It's worth reading to see what his process was. Yeah, the third book, that's tough. I'll tell you, the books that I have loved, the Master and Commander books, Aubrey Maturin series. Have you ever heard of those? It was... They did one movie that had Russell Crowe and they combined two books together, which makes no sense. But it's this series of like 22 books. They're called The Aubrey Maturin. It's the most fun I've ever had reading. I think I've read them like three. There's 22 books or something. I think I've read them like three times since I discovered them. They're really fun because it starts out with... So the Russell Crowe character is Jack Aubrey. And he starts out... He's a master and commander, so he's not a captain of a ship, but he's trying to become... He's trying to get himself a ship and he gets assigned to this little boat and he gets a crew and they go out hunting for this bad guy in the seas. And it's like golden age of sailing, you know, England in the, like around sort of Napoleonic, just post-Napoleonic times, I think, or Napoleonic times. And it's battles that they have. But the guy has written it. The style is... It's Roman a fleuve or something like that. I don't really know how to say it, but it basically means it's like this flowing river. And so the story just, there's no start and finish. The story just keeps on going. He just keeps on writing. And he seems to have captured the, it sounds authentic. Like he knows about the ships and he knows what the language sounded like at the time. So it feels very authentic when you're reading it. And you can read one book and then it just goes straight into the next book. And he wrote 22 of them before he died. And I just think this, it's just spectacular writing, spectacular reading. And you see the two characters, Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin, I think his name is, who's the other character in the book, the doctor in the book. They're sort of very good friends and how they grow over time because Jack starts out without a ship and then he gets his ship and then he becomes a captain and then he becomes a commodore and then he becomes an admiral. And so you get to see all this stuff as it happens. It's really fun read. Yeah, I really enjoy them. I've read them 3 times. I'll probably go back and read them again. I've talked myself into it.
Yeah, very cool. That's I always find it interesting to hear what people read, because it's often completely unrelated to, you know, their profession or what have you. This is a really random aside, but I was watching season 2 of The Test came out on Amazon Prime last night, which is the documentary that follows the Australian Test cricket team. And Pat Cummins, the new captain, is a very avid reader, apparently. Like, he'd just read Harry Potter when he was a kid, and when he finished the last book, he'd start again and just go round and round in circles reading Harry Potter. But he pulled Principles from Ray Dalio off the shelf in season two when I was watching that last night. So didn't expect to see that one.
Oh, that's funny. My daughter started reading a few years ago. She's 9. She only started reading, I don't know, 7 or something like that. And I don't know what she read. And then somebody gave her Harry Potter, and she was just like a buzzsaw. She just went like read, didn't go to sleep that night, read through the whole thing, like woke up the next morning and said, I finished it. I need the next one. And so we got all of them, and she did exactly the same thing, read all the way to the end, started again, read all the way to the end. And she like, for her, it's so real. So show to the movies, like, that's an incredible franchise that Rowling came up with there. And it's amazing to see it sort of play out, whatever it is, 20 years after the fact or 25 years after the fact. My daughter just demolished them.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I'm one of those guys that does the annual Harry Potter marathon and watches all the movies, so I'm still right into it. Got a question here from Hamish Hodder. So Hamish is one of the 3 of us that came to the Berkshire meeting, by the way, so you may have briefly met Hamish. But he asks, what's something you found challenging or unexpected about asset management that you didn't know going in?
Yeah, so I found it very challenging. I'm not trying to say that I haven't found it challenging, but I kind of knew it was going to be tough. Like, there's 2 aspects to it. There's a business management, you know, there's an entrepreneurship business management side to it. And then there's the stock picking portfolio management side to it. And they're 2 sort of very different things. The business requires promotion and, you know, cash flow management and those sort of things, and there's a big compliance burden. And then the asset management, you know, the portfolio management. So I had done a lot of work on the portfolio management side, and, you know, I like businesses, I like business models, and I like thinking about that kind of stuff. And so I knew that this, you know, asset management is a good business, but it's also a business that's very competitive. And there's this sort of bias, I guess, in the industry. Like, you have to be careful not to be too self-promotional. Like, there's people really look down on that. So you have to be careful, and so I have to find a way to kind of promote. Like, you can't not promote, because otherwise you can't raise any money. But you can't promote too much, because otherwise, you know, then it looks a bit scammy. So it's hard to kind of strike the right balance. So my solution has been to sort of not really talk about my funds much on, or I can't talk about them on my podcast and other things like that, because it's, that would trigger compliance. But to talk about the strategy and the process that I go through as a way of sort of promoting. So people who like those strategies, people who like that approach, can come in and talk to me. And so that's been, you know, that's been the biggest learning curve, has sort of been getting good at promoting without triggering any of the compliance issues or looking too scammy. So that's the real challenge. But I think that people have done that successfully. Like, Buffett is a very good promoter of Berkshire Hathaway and Berkshire Hathaway's businesses, but no one would think that he's doing it in a sort of scammy way. And I think there are guys out there who do a very good job. I think, you know, O'Shaughnessy does a very good job. As someone who's doing it now, I think Cliff Asness does a very good job. I think Meb Faber does a very good job. I think Wes Gray does a very good job. All those sort of guys. So I sort of tried to model myself on those. And I talk about the process and the research and the craft of it, rather than, you know, can't talk about the returns and can't talk about that sort of stuff. But that's sort of been the way that I have done it. And I think it's a reasonable way of doing it. I think it's sufficiently promotional without being too promotional. But that's the line that I'm trying to work all the time.
Yeah, interesting. I think it's a good way to go about it, personally. I mean, you've managed to build a really good audience from the podcast and on Twitter through just, it is kind of Buffett style, like, just talking about investment principles and, you know, literally what's just flying through your head given what's going on in the markets and so on. So, I think it's a good approach.
Yeah, thank you. So that's been the business stuff. That's been interesting too. Like that sort of has partly, that's been one of the reasons that I changed my approach from more like trying to maximize return, still in a risk adjusted basis, to just really trying to minimize the risk. And that's something that you learn from running your own business that really apply. Like Buffett says it all the time, I'm a better investor because I'm a businessman. I'm a better businessman because I'm an investor. And I understand why he says that now. It's because there are things that you can't understand about business until you've had to do it in a business context. And then you see it happening in an investment, and it's sort of the actions mean more. I can interpret what people are doing because I've had that experience myself in the business and vice versa.
Yeah, completely agree. Let's do one last question. This is from Dino at Values Not Dead on Twitter. Classic. Has been offered any more narrating work since the journalistic app voiceover gig?
So it's funny. My wife works at PwC, and they had this podcast, and I did the voiceover for the podcast because it's like international podcast, so they needed like an international sounding voice. So I did that, and then Jake asked me, so I could never say no to Jake. So I did that. You know, I personally think it sounds, I don't like the sound of it, but you know, I want to support Jake, and I want to be involved in that project because I think it's a very, very good one. I think he'll do very well there. So he's got that Journalytic app, which is basically a journaling that they have then built this back end that analyzes your journal entries. Like, it's kind of brilliant. It's a really, really good way of investing. It's really the only way that you can become a better investor, because it's hard to get that feedback loop going when you're an investor, because the time between doing all the research and putting the position on, and then there's like nothing happens, and then you got to sit there for a quarter would be a long period of time in real life, but in terms of an investment, that's nothing. You know, it can take 3 to 5 years for these things to play out, and then you've completely forgotten why you did something, and so it takes that long to kind of get the feedback loop going. And I got around that by writing a blog. I had this Greenbacked, which was this, like, it was anonymous at the time that I was doing it. And just, so I was just free to write whatever I wanted on it. And that made me, for the first time, like, I'd been investing before that, but I hadn't been as disciplined about writing down my thesis and then updating it and following along. And that was the first time that I really started learning what I was doing. And so Journalytic, I think, creates that same thing without having to do it publicly. And I think it'll be very valuable. If people start using it, I think they'll get huge benefits out of it as fundamental investors.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've had a similar experience with, it wasn't a blog, it was a YouTube video. So I'm talking about companies. I've gotten better, I think, over time at, because I use investment checklists, for example, which I use, I just have an Excel, basically. And I'm going through and saying pass, fail, question mark, need to actually find out the answer to that question type stuff. And I'm writing notes right through. So it's been interesting to look back at that type of stuff. But Jake he's definitely step things up a few levels, I think.
I know that Monish Pabrai is a big proponent of checklists, and I think that was based on either a discussion with Guy Speer, or he read the book as well. There's an Atul Gawande book on checklist manifesto or something like that, which is, when you're hot on something, you want to fast forward through the process, and it's just good to have that thing. Because you probably find, and the nice thing about Journalytic is it'll tell you if you're making the same mistake over and over again. So you need to be ultra aware of that thing. And I think really investing is one of the, maybe there are many things like this, but the nice thing about investing is that the longer you do it, the better you do get at it. Experience does count for something in investing. And so why not kind of formalize that process and create the track record of all of your decisions for you? That's a great, it's a great idea, and it'll help you become a better investor.
Yeah, for sure. Toby, this has been a lot of fun. I know you need to get going shortly, but just one final question for people that aren't following you already somehow. Where can people go to hear more from you or check out what you're doing?
So I have a website, acquirersmultiple.com, and that's got all the books, and it's got a little screener for free that screens US listed stocks on a sort of deep value basis. And then it's got some paid screeners on there. And Johnny Hopkins finds all of this great research and industry sort of commentary, and he sticks it all up there. And then I'm on Twitter at greenbacked.com. I have a podcast called the Acquirers Podcast, Value After Hours. Comes out once a week. We record on Tuesdays live, and then we publish on Sunday night local time. And that's those are the best ways. I have some books out. Most recent one was The Acquirer's Multiple. So I read that came out in 2017. It's written to a fifth grade reading level. And you can read
that's
it in 2 hours.
That's why I enjoyed it so much, I guess.
it's so hard to write to that level. It's crazy. Like, if you look at the books that have sold a lot, so J.K. Rowling's book, all of those Harry Potter books, they're written to a fifth grade reading level. And so it's like Dan Brown, he's written to a fifth grade reading level. Mm. It's incredibly difficult to do. Like, they're doing it on purpose because more people can read them. It's so much easier to write, you know, choosing big, interesting words, but that sort of blows up your score. So I think it's a good exercise. I'm glad I did it. Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Sorry, did you cover all the bases there, Toby?
Yeah, that was it.
People can go? Okay.
Yeah, that was it. Perfect. Oh, the funds are Acquirers Fund, ticker ZIG, and then Roundhill Acquirers Deep Value, which is ticker DEEP. Check those out.
Awesome. Well, I will. I'll leave all those websites and Twitter and everything linked down in the description and show notes for people to check that out. But Toby, I'm glad we reconnected. This was fun, and we'll have to do round three at some point as well.
Oh yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, thanks for having me, Tom. It's always great to be on. I love chatting.
Awesome.
I look forward to seeing you in the next one.
Absolutely. Cheers, Toby.